As you can see, the reading is Mark 10, 35 through 45. This section of 10 verses relates to the request of James and John of Jesus and his response and regard to service. So I have a feeling that may be what we're going to hear about later. Then James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came to him. "Teacher," they said, "we want you to do for us whatever we ask." "What do you want me to do for you?" he asked. They replied, "Let one of us sit at your right and the other at your left in your glory." "You don't know what you're asking," Jesus said. "Can you drink the cup I drink or be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with?" "We can," they answered. Jesus said to them, "You will drink the cup I drink and be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with, but to sit at my right or left is not for me to grant. These places belong to those for whom they have been prepared." When the ten heard about this, they became indignant with James and John. Jesus called them together and said, "You know that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant. And whoever wants to be first must be slave of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many."
It's time for the Roots children to be dismissed. Let's sing as they leave. Jesus loves me, this I know.
Good morning. Good morning. Barbara, thank you for reading for us today. Winolia, thank you for your beautiful prayer, the prayer of Jesus over us, and forward your poetic words. May God hear those. More of that, please. That's good. Thank you. It's good to be with you all today. I am not the best darts player in the world. In fact, I don't even play darts very often. I can't even remember the last time I played darts against James Denham, maybe, and we both know how that game went. Both know who won. I do remember playing darts as a child, though, in junior high, upper elementary. It was at my uncle's house. Before his money dried up, my uncle had a game room that rivaled what you would see on modern-day HGTV. Competition-sized pool table in the middle of the room, large screen TV along the wall, and a Sega Genesis game system attached to it, a 10-foot bar with all the Lay's potato chips and Capri Suns a 9-year-old could ever want. In the corner, darts. The setup hid inside a glossy wooden box with double doors that swung open from the middle to reveal that perfect 17 3/4-inch fabric-covered bristle board. It looked like a colorful clock face, except there were 8 numbers too many, and they were all out of order. Spider-webbing it all were the metal strips that defined place value, and all the puck marks let you know how many thousands of the little arrows had impaled the thing since its purchase. Flanked to its left was the old school green chalkboard used for scorekeeping. Flanked to the right were the razor sharp darts nestled into slots to keep them organized and away from me. "Those are not toys," my mom would say. The dartboard stood tall at regulation height, precisely 5 feet 8 inches above the floor. A piece of masking tape on the ground marked the throwing distance, 7 feet 9 1/4 inches away. My uncle would toe the line against family members and friends and win every time. I know because I sat in the metal bar stools and watched along with my brother and my cousins. If we were lucky, we got to keep score. Cricket was the easiest to tally. 301 took a little bit longer because of all the math involved. If, when the dart slammed into the board, it lost its tail end, also known as a flight, if it lost its tail end and it floated to the floor, I would race over and pick it up and hand it back for reattachment. My uncle, as I said, was the best. It's a wonder, too, because he would throw while holding a Bud Light in his left hand and gripping a half-smoked cigar out the side of his mouth. Even through the cloudy haze in the room, I could see his steel-tipped dart zip through the air and pierce the board nearly always where he meant it to go. A 20 here, a 19 there. Bullseye, bullseye, bullseye. I thought about my uncle and his dart skills when I first began listening to this text a couple months ago. And I know the dartboard metaphor is not perfect. You get double the score for landing in the outer ring. You get triple the score for the inner ring. All the nuances that could poke holes in the imagery and make it leak meaning, I'm aware of. But I would venture to guess that most lay dart players like myself or non-dart players would say the best place, the only place you want the dart to go is right there in the center. That's the purpose of darts. That's the goal. That's the drive. Other numbers and colors fade away as that nickel-sized red dot entices you with its elusiveness, charms you with its potential, enchants your pursuit of perfection. And when you hit that bullseye, the very center, the cheers go up, even if no one is there. You did it. Great shot. Skilled in the ways of human nature, it's no surprise Jesus' disciples knew, or thought they knew, how to throw with precision in order to hit the bullseye, in order to cozy up to the nucleus where good things happen for you. Get close enough to the person at the center, the one who seems to have the might and the charisma and the crowd, and ride their coattails to victory and placement and power. That's how you win the end game, the disciples reasons, which makes all the sense in the world when you consider how all the powers everywhere and for all times came to be. Except following Jesus is not a game. It's not a game of darts. It's not a game of thrones. It's not a game of win, lose, or draw. Following Jesus is a death of sorts. Sometimes even the real thing. That's what Jesus had been trying to teach his disciples for so long now. In the section right before ours, Jesus foretells what's going to happen to him. They were on their way to Jerusalem with Jesus leading the way, and the disciples were astonished, while those who followed were afraid. Again, he took the 12 aside and told them what was going to happen. "We're going up to Jerusalem," he said. "And the Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and teachers of the law. They will condemn him to death and hand him over to the Gentiles, who will mock him and spit on him, flog him and kill him. 3 days later, he'll rise. This is the third time in Mark that Jesus has given those same dire predictions. And for the third time, the disciples don't get it. James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came forward to Jesus and said to him, "Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask." It's a curious statement, one that even James and John seem to sense as misguided. It's like how sheepish little children ask for something they know their parents will not give to them, and so they backdoor their way into their request. "Daddy, do you love me?" "Of course I do, sweetheart. Then can I have dessert?" In Matthew's version of the story, they get their mom to do their dirty work for them. It says this, "Then the mother of the sons of Zebedee came to Jesus with her sons, and kneeling before Jesus, she asked a favor of him. And he said to her, 'What do you want?' And she said..." By posing their desire in a roundabout way, they are trying to trick Jesus into granting their wish. Jesus isn't buying it, of course, but he goes along. Back in Mark, he asks James and John, "What is it you want me to do for you?" Ah, there it is, the blank check question. We would all love to hear that. And from Jesus, of all people, what's the one thing that you want? What's the one thing? Cure, grant, give, make, hold, pay, increase, take, remove, destroy. What is it that you want me to do for you? How you answer this question reveals the content of your heart, of course. What's the most important thing to you in this moment? Caleb McDaniel will talk more about this question next Sunday. We learn the content of James and John's hearts pretty quickly. When you sit on your glorious throne, we want to sit in the places of honor next to you, one on your right, one on your left. Arrange it so that we will be awarded the best seats in the house when you are finally in charge, when your earthly kingdom finally comes. Cabinet positions would be nice. We can be co-vice presidents. He can sit to your right, I can sit to your left, and we'd like a barista whenever we crave a cappuccino. How useful we can be to you. The closer to the center of power James and John gets, the nearer to the bullseye they are able to throw themselves, the more benefits and accolades there will be since they are associated with the ruling party. They've seen what Jesus brings to the table: miracles, feeding the masses, magnetism, and they lobby for preferential treatment. "Yeah, I'll take what he's having." What's Jesus' response? Does he suppress a laugh? Does he roll his eyes? Does he shake his head and sigh? While it's anyone's guess what Jesus' body language is saying, we do know what he spoke. "You do not know what you are asking," he says. Because in just a few short chapters, Jesus' body will be hanging on a bloody cross. To his left and to his right will dangle two criminals. No glory will be found there that day, even though Jesus will be enthroned as king. A cross for a throne and thorns for a crown. James and John literally do not know what they are talking about, because if they did, there's no way they would ask for these spots. Pain and shame and disappointment are coming, Jesus knows, which is why he asks, "Are you able to drink the cup that I drink or be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with?" Say that five times fast. To this tongue twister of a statement, James and John respond with a, "Sure we can. Yes, we will drink that cup that you drink, and yes, we will be baptized like you. Yes, we know there might be a few bumps in the road, but we're good. We got this." In a bit of a surprise move, Jesus does not rebuke them. He doesn't correct them. Instead, he affirms their answer. He accepts their words, but turns their answer right side out. "Come to think of it, you will drink the cup I drink. You will be baptized in my baptism." Jesus means it as a cup of suffering and the baptism of death. They think of the cup and baptism as a way to share His glory, His splendor, His rule. But Jesus is patient with them again. And He's also firm, and He points them in the right direction, the way He Himself is going. He knows they'll soon be called to sacrifice everything, drinking to the dregs from the cup, plunging lower than they ever thought possible into the waters of baptism. In the meantime, He's not concerned about the places of honor. "That's not my business. God has those arrangements taken care of." As self-absorbed, vain, and ambitious as the sons of Zebedee come across, they simply represent the whole bunch of disciples. The other 10 are not any better. All 12 are implicated. Hearing what happened, they are angry with the brothers. They are outraged. They are indignant. As Dee explained 2 weeks ago, Jesus was indignant when these same disciples did not allow children to come near Him. At the complete opposite end of the spectrum, the disciples are indignant with the other two when they backstab them, go behind their backs. The 10 may masquerade their wrath as some kind of righteous indignation. But the picture we get is a group of men who are angry because they want those places of glory for themselves. They are no different than James and John. At this point in the story, maybe our own body language is saying something. Laughing at those clueless young men, rolling eyes at their ridiculousness, shaking heads and sighing at their foolishness. How do they not get it? What an embarrassment to our faith. And it is, until that gnawing within compels us to ask ourselves, forces me to ask myself, am I really that different? I may not make outlandish, insensitive public requests, but the truth of the matter is that I want a lot of things I would never admit out loud. In my heart, I often covet the best of the lot, the top spot, the place of recognition. I confuse purpose and meaning with hope for personal success and ambition. I send family members to do my own bidding. I blame others rather than take responsibility. I argue with people when they step on my turf. I conflate my own central importance. I have this incurable tendency to put myself first. Since Our congregations are full of people like this. The church is not exempt. We're not exempt from such behavior, which becomes evident given how silly we look sometimes when we desperately compete and claw and coerce and condemn among ourselves, even as the planet and her people cry out for restoration around us. Father Zebedee had many sons and daughters, and I am one of them, and so are you. So let's all. Why the constant bullseye mentality? Why the inherent need to target ourselves toward the middle? Why is hurling darts sunk into our DNA? In Mark 10:32, a verse we read earlier, we find this. They were on their way up to Jerusalem with Jesus leading the way. And the disciples were astonished, and those who followed were afraid. Those who followed Jesus were afraid. They were scared. Understood within this context, we begin to have more sympathy for James and John. Maybe their hunger for power is rooted in something deeper than their want of high-profile jobs. Maybe Jesus' dismal plan had become clear to them. Maybe they do recognize what lays ahead. And being afraid, what is their response? They pursue the promise of a secured future, reacting quite naturally on their anxieties for the unknown. Their fear writes a contingency plan for them, a fail-safe, a guarantee in an environment full of questions. Their fear wants assured protection against whatever aggression may or may not be around the bend. Their fear intends to buy an insurance policy from the one salesman who seems to know what in the world is going on. Fear breeds the desire for security, and the sons of Zebedee are first in line. Thanks be to God that Jesus gets that. Thanks be to God that Jesus' counsel and direction for his shaky disciples is not one of despair or cynicism, but of wisdom and of grace and going to Jerusalem anyway. He stops in his tracks and huddles his followers together. And with great patience and great love, he teaches them again the lesson he's been teaching all along. You know that the rulers of the world lord it over their people, and their officials flaunt their authority over those under them. But among you it will be different. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be slave of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. The challenge to and the antidote for the fear-driven pursuits of security is this: the way of the cross. The world is saturated with people who chase after titles and sway and authority, and they brandish themselves and their muscles to prop themselves up and make sure that no one takes control away from them. Governments and boardrooms and caste systems and family structures and marriages. Not so with you. That is not how you shall live. Try this instead. You want to be great? You want to make something great? Awesome. And serve. Go grab that apron. Wrap it around your waist. Wash somebody's feet. You want to be first? Terrific. Then go willingly to the back of a line. Head to the edges of the board. Aim for the margins instead. While you're there, look over the side. Anyone fallen off? Anyone pushed over? Any subordinates? Any losers? Any outsiders? Any shamed? Then jump down and sit among them. And then bear the suffering that will inevitably come as a result. What a threat to our sensibilities. What a menace to the messages we read and the news that we hear and to our natural movements. But it's exactly what the Son of Man has done. He came to serve, not to be served, and to give His life away in exchange for those who are held in hostage. Jesus, the one who lays down His life for us, leads the way, not us. And we very clearly are called to emulate His example as we risk living fully. We have to trust that God is going to be there to catch us. We risk serving fully because Jesus says, that's where you'll find me. We have permission to drop the darts altogether. No more of this game. I don't want to play anymore. And in the irony of ironies, the further you find yourself from the established bullseye, the closer you'll find yourself to the one center that truly matters. The cross with Jesus nailed to it. And the ever unfolding, ever revealing reign of God. And then we are totally free. Let me finish with two things. First, I want you to know something about the two people who are currently shepherds in this congregation. Being a leader in a church is a volunteer job. It's a good one, a difficult one. I also believe it's a calling. In my 11 plus years of being here, never once have I seen Michael or Larry grasp for greater personal control over the church. Nor have I seen them twist arms to accomplish secret agendas. Nor have I seen them develop a sense of entitlement. Never once have I heard them claim some kind of sketchy biblical authority to toss their weight around. Nor heard them try to exert their will through hostile power plays. I have seen and I have heard hundreds of times these two who, because they love Jesus, lay down their lives for you, often in quiet, behind-the-scenes ways. They have sought wisdom in their weaknesses through prayer and discernment. Mostly, they have entrusted the life of this congregation to the hands of God's Spirit. And I give thanks to God for them. If you have not written an encouragement card to them lately, today is a great day to do so. Second, in a bull's-eyed world, steered by fear and ambition, how can we be reminded of our "not so with you" call? What will sustain us in the alternative way of Jesus? What is the why that will pry us off center? Remember what Jesus said to James and John, "The cup that I drink, you will drink. And with the baptism with which I am baptized, you will be baptized." Sometimes these words are read as a warning. James and John, heads up, you're going to be crucified, you're going to be killed. Let's also read it this way, as a promise. You will drink. You will be baptized. Baptism, and Eucharist. Baptism and the meal of thanksgiving. Baptism and the Lord's Supper. Baptism and communion. Do you remember your baptism? Where you were? How old? Where you were? Who was there with you? Who baptized you? Was it hot water? Was it cold water? The words you spoke, the yes that you gave, the plunging beneath the water, the lifting up. Do you remember this? Being baptized involves entering the way of the cross, taking up your cross and following Jesus. And the cup that you drink from, you do not drink from it alone. The cup of the Eucharist, the cup of God's table is shared by the community of faith who together enter the way of the cross. Baptism and cup will sustain us as we participate in them. The water and the blood will pry us off center because they tell us again and again, fears and security, that is not who we are. That is not what we need. We have Jesus' promise that we can and we will live as faithful disciples as we seek to follow Him, laying down our lives for others just as Jesus did for us. Yes, together, let's say amen to that. The water is ready to be stirred behind me. If you feel the call to be baptized today, in a moment, you can come up and talk to me. In a few moments, the bread and the cup, which are already provided for you, they're already here, they're waiting for you. They are here as a gift that we get to share in together. Thanks be to God. Let's stand and worship God together.
One heart, one spirit, one voice.